Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, why we must have transparency for trusts as well as for companies.
What's happened worldwide is a new phenomenon which I've called beneficial ownership avoidance. The danger is that if one of these structures is established by someone who is less than scrupulous, the client going forward can say, when asked, do you have an interest under a trust anywhere? The answer is no. Do you own this particular asset? No.
But first, here's a roundup of the latest tax justice news. The TaxCast was in Luxembourg this month for the appeal of the LuxLeaks whistleblowers, former employees of PricewaterhouseCoopers, Antoine Deltour and Raphael Allais. Also dragged back to court was journalist Edouard Perrin, who helped them expose the secret tax deals multinational companies were doing with the Luxembourg tax authorities. Raphael Allais puts it very nicely. He said, when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes a duty.
So we're here in the central square in Luxembourg, outside the Constitutional Court, with people from more than 20 countries assembled here to thank the whistleblowers and the journalists as they arrive in court. And they're forming a corridor of welcome in front of the courthouse.
In the initial trial, journalist Edouard Perrin was acquitted, but the whistleblowers got fines and 12-month and 9-month suspended jail sentences. They appealed that verdict, and so did the Luxembourg prosecutor, because he wants tougher sentences. The person that signed and rubber-stamped nearly all the tax rulings in Luxembourg for years, former tax chief Marius Kohl, failed to come to court to answer questions for the second time, producing another medical note from his doctor. According to Raphael Allais, this man, Marius Kohl, met once a month with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and during those meetings, he'd sign off on several tax rulings a time. Each one is hundreds of pages long. Remarkable efficiency, no? Anyway, the appeal's expected to end just before Christmas. The Australian government's going to review how they're taxing petroleum after warnings from the Tax Justice Network there that the country was failing to collect fair tax revenue from the boom in liquefied natural gas exports. In the United States, there's been no growth for the bottom 50% of incomes since 1980. That's according to research from economists Thomas Piketty and Gabriel Zucman. Compare that just as the wealthiest administration in modern US history is about to take up the reins of power. As the appointees sell off some of their holdings to avoid conflicts of interests in their new positions, perish the thought, they'll avoid paying millions of dollars in taxes because of a special deal for incoming high-level White House staff. According to The Economist, when President George W. Bush appointed Henry Paulson of Goldman Sachs as Treasury Secretary, he dodged $200 million in taxes when he sold off lots of Goldman stock. Very nice. Also this month, we've had more revelations from the so-called football leaks. More than 18 million documents revealing what appear to be tax avoidance schemes churned out on an industrial scale for wealthy football players. British Overseas Territory, the British Virgin Islands, seems to star in the schemes revealed so far. But not all footballers go along with all this stuff. The father of Norwegian footballer Martin Odegaard, who plays for Real Madrid, refused to have anything to do with these schemes, and he said about his son, quote, he's going to earn a lot of money anyway. It's a moral question not to save on a few taxes while other people struggle to pay their bills. And finally, you couldn't make it up. This week in France, the minister who was appointed to tackle tax evasion was jailed for 3 years for tax fraud. You may remember on the TaxCast we talked about Jérôme Cahuzac resigning back in 2013 after investigative reporters exposed his undeclared Swiss bank account. He used to rail against the wealthy for hiding their wealth offshore, and it turns out he was a serial offender himself with millions in offshore accounts. Those are the Tax Justice headlines for this month. Now we're going to chew over what's to come in 2017 with John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Okay, John, this month we're going to look at the really big stories that are going to dominate next year in our view. One of them is tax, financial secrecy and the impact on human rights. And the other is the acceleration of tax wars between nation states triggered by President-elect Donald Trump. Anyway, let's start with the human rights issue. So every so often, nations are called to appear before the United Nations to answer to their progress and their contributions to the conventions that they've all signed up for. Really good to see them be under this kind of pressure.
Yeah, you know, many people will probably feel that 2016 hasn't been the best year of their lives. So here's some good news at last. And it's I think news which will go towards making the world a very much better place if we carry it forward. Until recently, not many people had joined the dots between tax justice and human rights. But think about it for a second. Human rights cost money, not least the cost of running courts to defend human rights, and that money comes largely from tax. So there is a clear link. So when big corporations avoid paying tax, and tax havens support tax evasion and avoidance, they are knowingly depriving states of the revenue they need to fulfil their human rights obligations. There's the link. And with this in mind, earlier this year, a coalition of civil society organisations, including Tax Justice Network and our colleagues in New York at the Centre for Economic and Social Rights, we submitted a request to the United Nations Committee responsible for monitoring compliance with the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. And we asked them to investigate Switzerland. Now, everyone knows Switzerland is a major tax haven. It's banking secrecy and its corporate tax regime encourages capital flight, it encourages tax evasion, and it encourages corporate tax avoidance. And this deprives some of the poorest states in the world of the resources they need to fulfil their human rights obligations. Now, while the Swiss Federal Council has publicly earlier this year recognised that capital flight harms development and harms some of the poorer countries, the Swiss government has resolutely refused to conduct an independent assessment of how its own policies provide opportunities for illicit financial flows and tax evasion. So it's really good news that CEDAW has concluded its review of Switzerland and has been very critical of the Swiss government's lack of transparency and weak commitment to cooperation. In CEDAW's own words, Switzerland's financial secrecy policies and rules on corporate reporting and taxation have a potentially negative impact on the ability of other states, particularly those already short of revenue, to mobilise the maximum available resources for the fulfilment of women's rights. That's quite a strong statement. Now, CEDAW has urged Switzerland to honour its human rights obligations by conducting a periodic impact assessment of how its secrecy laws and its corporation tax regime impacts on women's rights. And there's further good news along the same vein. Shifting the geographic focus away from Switzerland, in June of this year, the United Nations Committee Monitoring Economic, Social and Cultural Rights called on the United Kingdom government to recognise and address the human rights impacts of its own financial secrecy policies, which of course also includes the Crown dependencies and overseas territory tax havens, which are British.
And of course, that would be number one on the financial secrecy index, the United Kingdom, if you were to include all its satellite havens that you just mentioned. So a really big player also having to account for these things.
That's absolutely right. Of course, Switzerland currently is at number one, but if we were to aggregate the British government, that is the City of London, along with the Crown dependencies, Jersey, Guernsey and the Isle of Man, all of which are tax havens, secrecy jurisdictions, plus the overseas territories, which are British, Cayman, British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, etc., then Britain would be the number one player. And of course, in the fullness of time, we really must start to focus on the giant, the elephant in the room here, and that is the United States, which increasingly is looking like its development strategy will be around becoming the world's biggest tax haven.
And we'll definitely be focusing more on this in the coming year.
You bet.
Let's talk about the other big story I mentioned earlier, which is worrying tax justice campaigners and should worry any citizens anywhere, actually. This big stepping up of the race between nations on tax. And I mean, the worry isn't just that it's a race between nations to the bottom on tax, but also starts to extend to regulations and subsidies and all sorts of other aspects of corporate welfare, sweeteners and goodies offered by governments. So Donald Trump announced very quickly a 15% corporate tax rate. UK's hinted it will go to less than the 17% it had already planned. Hungary's just dropped to 9%, but apparently corporations there are paying closer to 1% to 2%, as in Ireland, as we know, supposedly 12.5%, but Apple paid actually less than 2%. So this isn't going anywhere very good, but it's going there pretty fast, isn't it?
Yes, they're lining up on the block for the next round of this crazy race to the bottom. Representing the United States, we have President-elect Donald Trump, who's signalling a whacking cut to the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%. And incidentally, his trainer, Arthur Laffer, famous economist who's curved the Laffer curve, has proven worthless for over three decades, has described Trump's plans as tax nirvana for the United States. And many billionaires will no doubt agree with him. Next up on the blocks is British Prime Minister Theresa May, whose finance minister has already confirmed the UK tax rate will fall to 17%. Despite cutting the tax rates drastically for the last 10 years, the corporate community shows absolutely no signs at all of increasing investing in Britain. In fact, investment has plummeted since 2008, which is one of those inconvenient truths. Then we have French presidential candidate François Fillon, who describes himself as a fan of Mrs. Thatcher, also promising significant cuts to the corporate income tax rate there. Let's not forget also the Japanese Prime Minister, Abe, who is promoting Japan as business-friendly by cutting taxes and creating export processing zones. So tax competition, the race to the bottom, is accelerating. And this is a game or a race for losers. The biggest losers, of course, are ordinary citizens who will end up losing their public services and carrying more public debt. Young people will lose most since rising inequality, falling investment, reducing innovation and less job creation will ultimately wreck social stability. And we're already seeing all the signs of that right the way across Europe and North America. But this doesn't end with big businesses paying no tax and free riding on public services paid for by others, which is what they do at the moment. Increasingly, corporations are demanding cuts in social protections, in environmental protections, all in the name of competitiveness. And yet, this does nothing at all to improve productivity or growth or the quality of economics anywhere. It's quite simply is a transfer of wealth to the corporate community.
We've said as well before that we're in the last years of corporate taxation, and that seems to be the way it's going very quickly.
Yes, and it's very worrying because if the corporate lobbyists achieve their goal, which is to abolish the corporate income tax, we don't just destroy the tax regimes of many, many developing countries which rely very heavily on corporate income tax, but we also destroy our ability more generally to tax wealth, since so many very wealthy people hold their assets, including, of course, their shareholdings, in some kind of corporate format. And so we lose the ability to tax that kind of wealth as well. So what's happening is that in the name of competitiveness, politicians are destroying social protections, they're wrecking the global economy, they're allowing multinational companies to free ride of the communities which they've occupied. And all this is being done in the name of a free market ideology, which is as much pie in the sky as Marxism-Leninism was in the bag ash days of the Soviet Union.
And it's really not what capitalism is supposed to be about. You know, they're going to take free money if they can get it, why not? But that's not going to determine decisions that they make in terms of jurisdictions, and we've seen that time and time again.
Well, that's quite right. I mean, in fact, this has turned the promise of globalisation onto its head. Globalisation was supposed to deliver jobs, technology transfer and tax payments. It's delivered some jobs, but increasingly those jobs are very poor quality, zero-hour contracts in many countries around the world, no pensions, blah, 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 very little in the way of genuine technology transfer, and the tax payments, as we can see now, the multinational companies are simply not delivering. So the promise of globalisation is not being delivered on.
thoughts, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We've had years of campaigning and research on the dangers of allowing the real or beneficial owners of companies to remain anonymous. There is now some movement by nations towards central registers with those details, some of them public, but as one stable door may be slowly closing, others are still wide open. This month, the TaxCast looks at the new game in town, beneficial ownership avoidance via trusts, a potential escape vehicle that remains in the shadows. Trusts tend to have a nice, cosy image of someone's rich granny leaving behind an inheritance for her kids and grandkids. But make no mistake, trusts are widely used for commercial purposes too. They can engage in business just like companies or directly own companies. They involve rights and control over assets, sometimes millions of dollars, and they provide a shield to protect them from outsiders. They can be used for perfectly legitimate reasons, but the Tax Justice Network believes they're an even bigger threat to democracy than anonymous shell companies, and they're harder to crack. The European Union law enforcement agency Europol recently identified the abuse of trusts as one of the main schemes for criminals hiding their assets. There are different challenges around the creation of a trusts register, but they can and must be overcome. Here's why. Case study number one. 2016's been a turbulent year for Brazil. You can hear these protesters banging pots and pans. I think they're angry about many things, but corruption's probably number one. 150 of the elected representatives who voted to impeach their president Dilma Rousseff have themselves been implicated in a much larger corruption scandal, involving $1.7 billion of bribes that we know about at the state-run oil company Petrobras.
This chap, Eduardo Cunha, who is the guy behind the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, he's the guy who pushed for her impeachment. He's just been arrested.
This is Richard Smith, financial dirt digger extraordinaire from the blog Naked Capitalism.
Back in May, it was discovered that he too had been using a trust company structure to hide what appeared to be bribes arising from the Petrobras corruption. It looks as if the attack on Rousseff was an attempt maybe to derail the investigation. If so, it hasn't worked. He was arrested on corruption charges in October. So there we are. We've got sort of grand corruption and, from the look of it, some pretty high-level political chicanery.
He denies the allegations, and that story's far from over. Here's case study number two, Russia's Sergei Pugachev.
He was part of Putin's inner circle. He was one of Putin's oligarchs. Putin has this sort of rough and ready way, shall we say, of making sure that the group of oligarchs that basically back him stay on side. There's the sort of discretionary enforcement of the law in Russia, and they tolerate a certain amount as long as you don't fall out with Putin. And it appears that this fellow Pugachev did fall out with Putin and found that he was accused of basically embezzling a ton of money from this bank and salting it away offshore. And the Russian authorities, who've got plenty of legal muscle, managed to sort of discover where some of this was. And it turned out to be being held in a New Zealand trust. It always comes to court in the end, and usually in London. Great for the London courts, a venue for oligarchs to thrash things out with each other. And it's lucrative. It looks as if the Russians have managed to freeze about $1 billion worth of this guy's assets. The pursuit of Pugachev's assets has been going for about 5 years, and it's going to plough on for much longer yet. So, you know, it gives you an idea of the expense of tracing these things. And more impoverished, less powerful states than Russia have a significantly harder time in this asset recovery process, and it's because of the layers.
Here's case study number three.
Looking a little bit further afield, we've got the gigantic Unaoil scandal, where our UK Serious Fraud Office has concluded that Unaoil, which is supposedly a sort of middleman in oil deals in the Middle East, really actually wasn't a genuine business at all. The Serious Fraud Office, SFO man, is very outspoken. He says this is just a mechanism for conveying bribes back and forth. There's a sort of usual chain of obfuscatory ownership layers, but a New Zealand trust is part of it.
So, as you'll have noticed, all these cases feature trusts, trusts, and more trusts. New Zealand's Richard Smith's favourite area of focus for his investigations at the moment, and we'll come back to that. Here's a fourth case study from a lawyer based in the Isle of Man, the type of lawyer the unscrupulous don't get very far with, I'm pleased to say.
Three businessmen came from the Indian subcontinent directly to my office, well introduced, seemingly very respectable.
This is Paul Beckett, also of the cyber intelligence agency Sinceritas.
And we're talking about perfectly legitimate structures, holding structures, tax declared and so on and so forth, with regard to the ownership of their business. Within about 15 minutes, and they brought with them the chairman of a real chairman of a real bank in their capital city. Everything seemed totally legitimate. Until they started wincing when I was describing beneficial ownership registration of companies and various constraints and regulation. And then they said to me, but we own clothing and shoe factories. Now, the world is aware of disasters such as the Rana Plaza collapse, which was in Bangladesh, when many people were killed in a clothing and shoe factory because it was inadequately maintained. One of my other specializations is international human rights, with an emphasis on international human rights business law. So you can see I was concerned.
He showed them the door. But it's a good reminder that obscuring ownership can be as much about avoiding legal liabilities and escaping regulations as about dodging tax or laundering money. There's one type of trust in particular you identify as particularly dangerous, which we'll talk about in a moment. But in the wake of the Panama Papers leaks and with a changing regulatory environment, admittedly slow, do you anticipate some people will be getting advice now to shift their assets towards trust structures and other kind of escape vehicles?
I think in some jurisdictions there is a danger of that, yes. What's happened worldwide is a new phenomenon which I've called beneficial ownership avoidance. An ordinary trust, all questions of registration and public registers apart, a totally legitimate structure. The danger is that if one of these structures is established by someone who is less than scrupulous, the client going forward can say, when asked, do you have an interest under a trust anywhere? The answer is no. Do you own this particular asset? No.
Leaving political will and the motivations aside, the G20 leaders are presumably surrounded by experts and advisors working on rules around this stuff. So why is progress in this area so slow, do you think?
They are hopelessly out of touch with developments worldwide, and they're not fully informed of developments in the field of what we're calling beneficial ownership avoidance. That is where the problem lies. The principles that they have put forward, the high-level principles, the 10 of them, are very abstract. They call for example, a definition of beneficial owner, but they give no guidance whatsoever on what they mean by that. And in one of the principles, principle 10, they refer to curbing the use of bearer shares and controls on nominee shareholders and nominee directors. Well, how 1980s? If that's cutting edge analysis of what's going on worldwide, both onshore and offshore, then it does leave a great deal to be desired.
And it gets much worse, because let's talk about the trust vehicle you're most concerned about. According to you, there's a type of trust that even if there was a trust's register, which provides that critical information we need about ownership, a non-charitable purpose trust would escape that because there is no beneficial owner.
Well, a register of a non-charitable purpose trust will show the set law and will show the trustees But there is no beneficial owner. The cupboard is bare. There's no one to record. What if the buck doesn't stop at the doorstep of a particular person or company? And that's where beneficial ownership avoidance is so pernicious, because all the regulations in the world will not apply if there is nothing to which they can be applied, if there is no beneficial owner. The Isle of Man's version of this came in 1996 and has never been challenged. But there's a continued spread of this particular type of structure around the world. So the British Virgin Islands, 2013, Cayman Islands, 2011, revision of an earlier act, Cook Islands, as old as the Isle of Man, 96, Guernsey, 2007, Jersey, 96 revision, Labuan, Mauritius, Niue, Samoa, 2014. But the big surprise that I had was that identical wording to the usual suspects, you know, the offshore jurisdictions with non-charitable purpose trusts, identical wording is found in the domestic statutes in Delaware, New Hampshire, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And further countries are actually looking to see whether they will introduce them. New Zealand is toying with the idea, although it hasn't taken that step yet. Major countries. So you say, well, the easiest way would be to abolish non-charitable purpose trusts.
At the very least, that's what we should do, yes. And we should stop messing about and get on with public registers of trusts with the important information we need, which we can capture from other trust setups. Let's go back to Richard Smith from Naked Capitalism and the New Zealand trusts, which are proving so handy for oligarchs and assorted criminals, including the kickbacks around Brazil's state-owned oil company Petrobras, which we talked about earlier.
Historically, New Zealand trusts have been even more obscure than offshore companies. Up until very recently, there wasn't any kind of, well, in fact, right now, there still isn't any kind of central record of even the names of the trusts. You know, if you saw some trust name in a bank statement somewhere, if that was all you had, you wouldn't even know that it was a New Zealand trust. There's literally, you know, no public list. No private list, no anything. And in fact, when the Panama Papers blew up, the New Zealand government was caught completely on the back foot because it really had no idea of what was going on in there and what they all were. Another point, New Zealand doesn't have a tax information exchange agreement with Brazil. So there isn't even any kind of channel through which the information about the trust could be exchanged, even if somehow the Brazilians, you know, in some moment of inspiration realized that the entity they were looking at was a New Zealand trust, they still couldn't find anything out about it. Grotesque, really. Now, there are reforms in hand around New Zealand trusts, but as far as I can see, this Brazilian setup, if the Brazilian investigators haven't discovered the New Zealand connection by other routes, emails or something, they would still be scratching their heads over this, at what this damn thing was. They wouldn't even be able to ask the New Zealanders, and the New Zealanders wouldn't be able to tell them. It's kind of nuts.
So if we go back to the Russian oligarchy mentioned earlier, whose assets were frozen by the London courts, or what they could actually trace anyway, I mean, even with a case where so much money was available to chase him up, if we say that law enforcement authorities are running to catch up, it doesn't even begin to cover it, does it? And a country like New Zealand seems to be a good example of a growth area around trusts, which is really compounding the problem.
Yeah, so, you know, there's been this boom in New Zealand trusts, and the suspicion has to be that there's, you know, plenty more oligarchs and the like using these structures to obfuscate ownership. And this is a sort of good case study in just how long it takes to open these things up. There are 12,000 New Zealand trusts, most of them created since 2006. This is one of them. If you dealt with them in series, you'd be looking at 60,000 years to open the whole lot up. So I think what we're seeing here is just the tip of the iceberg.
It shows this right to privacy that's so often cited can't be absolute. It has to be balanced against the exercise of other rights and obligations, the give and take involved in being part of a society. Lawyer Paul Beckett.
In terms of companies, a company exists only because the state says it can exist. That's always been the case since the original state monopolies and state corporations of the 18th century onwards in Europe. If society says, OK, you can have limited liability, but we want to know what you're doing, that right to privacy is trounced by the public's right to know, because it's the public and the will of the public that maintains that corporation in existence as a limited liability entity. If the corporation wants total privacy, then abandon limited liability and just trade in your own name. Of course, international commerce would collapse if that were the case, because the whole structure is based on limited liability. So in brief, I would say, if it's a corporation, if it's a foundation, if it's a creature which is created by state legislation and maintained in existence by the will of the state, then privacy can be too much of a price for the people to pay. Corporate privacy, no problem. Let's scrap it. Personal privacy, big problem. And that's a philosophical debate for the next 5 years or 10 years.
And we can't afford another decade to win the argument for public registers for trusts. For as long as we only tackle anonymous ownership with registers for companies but not for trusts and foundations, this beneficial ownership avoidance game, this dash for new escape vehicles, will continue. As they say, sunlight is the best disinfectant. You've been listening to the Taxcast. That's it for now. We'll be back next month.